Well,
the hymns invoke the gods, and then the altars are set up for the rituals. Now, for a settled people, it's possible to worship in terms of the place where you live. This particular grove is a sacred grove, and we go there to get the inspiration of the powers of nature that are experienced there. Or this pond, or this particular old tree, or this strange, interesting rock. But when you are a nomadic people, your worship has to be to that which is everywhere. Now, the Hebrews had the ark, which is, in anthropological language, a fetish that's carried about with the divine power in it. The Hindus worshipped, the Aryas worshipped the sun, which is seen everywhere, the powers of the wind, clouds, broad-spreading earth, and they would set up their altars as symbolic representations of the nature of the universe, of the order and form of the universe. Then they would invoke the deities who would come, as it were, sitting around like birds on trees waiting to be fed, because we're going to have a shared feast. The fire, Agni, the god of fire, would be the mouth of the gods. And the offerings would be poured into the fire, and then Agni would take them like a mother bird takes a worm and feeds all the gods. So this little social, invisible society is to be thought of. The Greeks were doing the same thing. They also were Aryans. They also had their altars. They also had their priests. They also had their rituals, their offerings, and so forth and so on. So those are the Vedas. And as the Vedas are now in books, they were not turned into writing for many, many centuries. They were known orally and communicated orally. They are in the form that we now have them. They're dated from about 1000 BC. That's the first stage. That's the stage of myth and ritual. Then come a set of books, and now here's a big turning point, known as the Brahmanas, B-R-A-H-M-A-N-A-S, Brahmanas, the books of the Brahmins. The word Brahmin is written B-R-A-H-M-A-N, but the first A is a long A, and that long A means related to. The Brahmins are the priests, and they are related to Brahman, B-R-A-H-M-A-N, without a long A. It's a neuter noun, and it means brr. It means energy. That's the divine energy, the Brahman. Brahman is no deity. Deities are personifications of aspects of Brahman. And so are you, and so is the world. The Brahmins are those who are in touch with the energy of Brahman. And they go to work to interpret the meaning of the sacrifice. Now, these Brahmanas are very dreary books to read. They're pedantic discussions of the sacrifice, what it consists of, what the different ladles are like, and so forth and so on. But it comes to this final point. What is the nature of the sacrifice? And it's terribly important, because through the sacrifice, we influence the gods. This is the argument now. Therefore, the sacrifice is stronger than the gods. But who operates the sacrifice? The Brahmins. Therefore, the Brahmins are stronger than the gods. Therefore, an illuminated man is stronger than any deity. This is the great thing in the universe. And this is what the Brahmin is. Point one. So he controls the gods through the sacrifice. The sacrifice is almost like the console of a great organ. There sits the Brahmin, and he's manipulating the keys, and the whole world sings according to his play. What is the nature of the sacrifice that it does this? The nature of the sacrifice is you're pouring an offering into a fire. Now, when you take food to your mouth, you're pouring an offering into a fire. As the Hindus say, the heat of the body cooks the food, the digestive system cooks the food and turns it into body. This is what happens when we pour an offering into a fire. Ha-ha. The world is an ever-burning fire of sacrifice into which an inexhaustible sacrifice is being poured, and that's the nature of life. Think of it that way. We're all an offering being poured into the consuming fire. The first sermon of the Buddha is called his fire sermon, the one where he's sitting in the park of Benares. The lust of the senses is a burning fire. The hearing of the ears is a burning fire. The sight of the eyes is a burning fire. Quench that fire. Sense of the other tradition is, feed that fire. Now these are the two attitudes toward the mystery and terrific thing that life is. Life lives on life. Look at the birds. Look at the animals grazing. All they're ever doing is eating. They're killing things. And that's taking on gas. They wouldn't function otherwise. Life is an ever-burning fire. Feed that fire. Well, out of that comes a kind of passion for sacrifice. Now, the whole idea of sacrifice is one that I find really awfully hard to take. The idea that you kill some little animal and gain a benefit from it. Poor little thing. I remember going to the Kali Ghat at the time of the Durga Puja, and they were going to behead buffaloes and little goats and things like that. Well, I really chickened out. I saw a dear little goat being prepared, and the people who were preparing it just loved that goat, and they were putting little flowers on its head and making it very happy, and that head was going to be taken away. This is by magic. You're doing what the world does, and so you're going with it. You know the rule, if you're falling, dive. Do the thing that has to be done. And so there's this passion for sacrifice. But there's an earlier idea of sacrifice. It's connected also with jungle people and with agriculturalists generally, not in the sophisticated way of the Indian, but just when you go through the jungle, you see rotten trees, and out of them comes fresh green sprouts. Life comes out of death. So create death and you'll create life. That's the frightful, really horrendous, demiurgic approach to things. And with the Indian idea, this was accented. So we've come to this translation of myth into philosophy. The world is an ever-burning fire, and feed that fire. You feed that fire by the priestly sacrifices. But now comes the second stage in this philosophizing, the stage known as the Upanishads. If the Vedas date from 1000 BC, the Brahmanas date from somewhere around 900 to 800 BC, and about that time, there begin to come the Upanishads. The two big ones are the Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya. This is the essential shift now. Upanishad. Shad means to sit. Upani means close in. You sit close in to a teacher who teaches you close in doctrine. The teacher says, so when you take food to your mouth, this is a sacrifice. The fire within you is the Agni, the fire of the sacrificial flame. Why go to the Brahmins? You've got it in yourself. Turn in. And all those gods that you are invited to worship through the public sacrifice, they're projections of the fire of your own energy. And there's that wonderful passage in the Chandogya. Worship this god, worship that god, one god after another. Those who follow this law do not know. The source of the gods is in your own heart. Follow the footsteps to that center and know that you are that of which the gods are born. That's an idea that already occurs in Egypt. It It's the basic idea of the philosophy, the perennial philosophy. The deities are symbolic personifications of the very energies that are of yourself. And these energies that are of yourself are the energies of the universe. And so the God is out there and the God is in here. The kingdom of heaven is within you, yes, but it's also everywhere. And this is perennial philosophy stuff. So it's with that that we now come to the business of finding the fire in yourself. It's a psychological act of discrimination, viveka, discriminating between the physical transforming aspect of your entity and that enduring flame of which your youth and age and birth and death are but the inflections. So then we have the different disciplines to come to this. Now, the early Upanishads seem to date somewhere around 800 BC, and in India, an extremely recondite analysis, undoubtedly fostered by the experiences of yoga, which are all inward, led to an extremely complex and sophisticated psychology. This is known as the Sankhya philosophy, S-A-N-K-H-Y-A, the Sankhya. It's an analysis of the psychology of the inward being. Then there appear a number of teachers with circles of devotees, gurus, and their shishyas, or students, and teaching. Now, the teacher properly is one who has found and identified himself with that fire. So he speaks with the voice of the fire. We get the same thing from Jesus 500 years, 600 years later, where he identifies himself with the fire, with the Christ energy which supports all beings, and speaks out of that. He doesn't speak as Jesus of Nazareth, born of Mary. He speaks as the twice-born, the one who has taken birth, the virgin birth of the recognition of the spiritual life, which is his true life. And so the gurus. Now, this period is a fascinating one. It's a period of enormous transformations. In Persia, there's a great teacher at this time, Zoroaster. And the gathas, or hymns, of Zoroaster are so close to Sanskrit that the Persians and Aryans of India cannot have been long separated when these were written. The languages were too close. And so the probable dating of Zarathustra is somewhere around the time of these Upanishads. Now, it's out of the Zoroastrian or Zarathustra message that our whole Western tradition comes, in contrast to that which is of the Buddha. So I want to say something about that first and then talk about the Buddha. I have 10 minutes in which to do this. Zoroaster was totally against sacrifice. He was totally against the whole drift of these psychologies in India and of the earlier mythologies that were concerned with putting yourself in harmony with the universe. Zoroaster, in his mythology, sees two gods, Ahura Mazda, the lord of light, after whom the Mazda bulbs were named. Ahura means kind of spirit, and Mazda is this particular spirit of light. Ahura Mazda, who is all light, all benevolence, all power, all knowledge. And then against him is the opposite deity called Angra Mainyu, A-N-G-R-A, M-A-I-N-Y-U, who is darkness, hypocrisy, and deception. What he has done has been to concretize two opposites, the good and the evil, the light and the dark, have been here personified, over-personified, you might say, as gods. And the mythology is as follows, that the good God created a good world which was all light, consequently invisible. To see something, you have to have shadow. And Angra Mainyu, who's always late and always jealous, is angry at seeing this and decides to do something about it and pours darkness and sin and everything nasty into it. And so there is a fall. And so the universe consists of a good and an evil power in conflict and in union. So do not put yourself in harmony with the universe. That's exactly what you mustn't do. That's what you are in the first place. You're a mixture. You must, through intention, through decision, through action, and through courage, align yourself with what you recognize as the good. And then the myth tells that there came into the world a savior to teach the way to accent the good. And as a result of the action of this savior, there is now taking place a restoration. There are the good people who are restoring the world to its original condition, so that you have a straight line ascent to a restoration. And there will come a time when the crisis will occur, when all darkness will be wiped out. There will be a second coming of the Savior in the form of a figure known as Sao Shiant, and darkness will be permanently eliminated, the Lord of Darkness himself eliminated, and there will be nothing but light again. Do you recognize the story? And so we have here on this western coast, this western side of the story, this idea of don't put yourself in accord with nature. Fix nature up. And your crowd is the one that's doing it. We move now over to the Buddhist side, see? And what the Buddha is saying is, yes, all life is sorrowful. That's the nature of life. Good and evil, everything, all these names that you give things, that which is good, that which is evil, it's all a mix, and that's the way it is. The Buddha used actually the terminology of a Hindu medical man. Medical man comes in and observes the patient. What's wrong with the patient? The patient is suffering. Is there a cure? Is there a cure for suffering? All life is suffering. There is a cure for suffering. The cure for suffering, what is the cure? Nirvana. What is the healthy state? Now, what is nirvana? There are many ways of getting this wrong. Nirvana consists in the psychological stance that makes you indifferent to suffering. What is it that turns your life into nothing but suffering? It is desire and fear. Desire for something. Some delusory desire, and fear lest you should lose something. And this desire and fear, when they are quenched, you come to what's known as the Mahasukha, the great delight, the realization of rapture. And when you have when you're experiencing rapture, pain doesn't hurt. And it's that getting into a center that gives you such a participation in the rapture of the process, that you're right in the center there and are neither winning nor losing. You're in being. I mean, this is nirvana. Now, there were many people talking about nirvana in the Buddhist time. One of the great groups were the Jains, J-A-I-N. It may well be that those figures that we saw seated in yoga posture were Jains. Jainism goes back almost undoubtedly to the Indus Valley time. Jainism, however, was extremely physical in its notion of achieving nirvanic release. The essential idea in Jainism was that the soul, what's called the jiva, the living monad, is infected with action, which is called karma. And this action blackens and renders heavy the luminous jiva. Now, they don't try to say how it happened. All they're saying is, this is the way it is. And the goal of their yoga is to clean out the black, clean out action. And how do you do it? By sitting, mula bandha, all senses closed, not acting, but you're breathing still. Boy, that's an act. So the problem with the Jain is to die not one moment before you have become completely released from the desire to live. It's harder than you think to get to not to want to live. And so the Jain community is of two groups. One is the secular group. This is the lay community who hope that in a number of incarnations later they'll get be ready for this next act. And next are the monks and nuns who have cut themselves off from life and are, as it were, dead. They're trying to die. First step, of course, even the lay people take this step, is vegetarianism. You're on the way, my friends. This is saying no to the way life is. We don't kill and eat animals. Well, you're killing and eating plants. Okay, the Jains recognize that too. So there's another step where you don't kill and eat plants either. You wait for them to die. That's a nice supper for you. You don't pick an apple from a tree. You wait for it really to be dead. Also, you're very careful about drinking water at night, lest there be a little bug in it or something. And in Bombay, which is where the Jains remain, there are very few of them left, naturally, you see people walking with the sort of surgeon's cheesecloth across the mouth, so they shouldn't breathe bugs in and so forth. In fact, there was a very amusing custom in the old days in Bombay. Two chaps with a bed full of bed bugs, and they'll be walking through the town with the bed full of bed bugs saying, who will feed the bugs? Who will feed the bugs? I mean, you're being generous to life. I don't know why you want to foster life and kill your own, but that all religions have a point of absurdity in them. Well, a lady will then throw a coin out the window, and one of these two chaps will lie in the bed and become a grazing ground for the bed bugs, and he'll get the coin and she'll get the merit. On the other hand, you're trying not to eat yourself. And what the first thing to do is to limit the number of steps you take a day, because every step you're pressing down on the ground and probably killing some little thing that's got its little dwelling underneath and so forth. So the days are gradually reduced to sitting where you are and not eating, and then, of course, it happens. The Buddha said, no, no, no. He said, this is reading the whole thing physically. What you must die to is psychologically your desires and your fears. And then in a very interesting way, life becomes positive. Well, we'll talk about that a little later.
In discussing the perennial philosophies, Campbell speaks of the elementary ideas common to humankind, elementary ideas expressed in the folk experience of different cultures throughout history. How do these ideas relate to the modern world? Do they change with changing times?
The elementary ideas do not change. The problem is not to lose touch with them. And when the folk ideas, which relate to a certain social order and structure, are no longer functioning for that structure because another structure has come along, we are in psychological disarray. And this is one of the problems today. Do you see what I mean? And these days, the social system and social ideals and also the physical environment is changing so fast that there is no opportunity for a constellation, for a crystallization, you know, for a tradition to develop. Just in my own lifetime, I can't believe it. The transformation not only physically, but the transformations in terms of ethics and how people are expected to behave, it's been prodigious. When I was a very little boy down here on 98th Street and Riverside Drive, my uncle came in and said, Joe, we're going down, it was late in the afternoon, we're going down to Riverside Drive to see a man fly an aeroplane from Albany to the Battery. And this was the longest flight ever. And it was Glenn Curtis flying a sort of flying bicycle down the Hudson River. And you remember, everybody's standing along that, all the buildings with people on top watching for this thing to happen. And as the sun went down, it was twilight, we saw this thing coming and everybody shouted, there he is, there he is, there he is. That was when I was a little boy. And the year I left Columbia to go to study in France and Germany was the year Lindbergh flew across the water in that little thing. You can see it in the St. Louis airport. And now they're on the moon. My God. Just in terms of mechanics, it's been a terrific thing that's happened. And the whole, not only the actual act, but the notion of consciousness, the notion of man's relationship to the universe is transformed by these things. So we're in a big change. And the problem of the poet, the problem of the artist, is to relate the actualities of the contemporary circumstances to the elementary. That's the function of the poet, to make these things shine with the radiance of the path, you know?